morning. Go ahead and be seated. Okay. Next matter on calendar is docket number 54491, Duodoni versus State of Nevada. Ms. Thomas, are you ready? Would you like to reserve a little time?
I would like to reserve 5 minutes.
Okay.
Good morning, Chief Justice Carragherry, members of the court. I'm Jonelle Thomas, and I'm pleased to appear today on behalf of the appellant, Abel Duodoni. This appeal presents two issues. The first is whether in a case such as this, where a defendant enters a guilty plea, the judge retains discretion over the sentence to be imposed, and the judge is still available should the sentencing hearing be held before that judge who took the plea. The second is whether there should be a new sentencing hearing in this case based upon the curse words, the racially charged terms, and the threats that were used by victim and tax seekers against the defendant. As to the first issue.
Well, can I ask a question about your brief on page 5 of the footnote as to whether or not we even have jurisdiction to hear this? Because hasn't this appeal been dismissed originally as untimely?
Your Honor, a subsequent appeal was dismissed as untimely. There was a motion for a new sentencing hearing. Following the judgments of conviction here, there were two judgments of conviction, two notices of appeal here. Then there was a ruling on a motion for a new sentencing hearing. We weren't served with that notice, or with the order denying that. We missed the notice of appeal that's pending before the district court on a Lozada appeal issue. So that issue remains pending, but this appeal is properly before this court.
For both issues?
For both issues, I believe that it is. This court might find that the second issue is waived because it wasn't raised in the that the same judge issue was waived because it wasn't raised in front of the district court. And I imagine that's something we'll discuss today. But certainly everything that's relevant here, that's cited here, all took place in this appeal. And I don't rely upon anything following the filing of the notice.
Does plain error apply to both issues?
I believe that it does.
So why would plain error apply to the first issue? There's no case law in Nevada that would indicate any error.
I agree that the better approach by far would have been to have the objection and to have this issue raised. But I still think that this court can address the issue for two reasons. One is that although there is no case law in Nevada, there is case law addressing this issue. There's an ABA standard addressing this issue.
I think California and Michigan are the only two jurisdictions that have really adopted that type of an argument, and California is a little bit inconsistent.
I think that California, especially on the waiver issue, some courts of appeals in California would require a knowing waiver by the client as to the Arbuckle issue, as they phrase it there. Other courts of appeals would require an objection. That issue has not been resolved by the California Supreme Court. But the California Supreme Court and the California Courts of Appeals are consistent in holding that where a defendant enters a plea with an expectation that the judge who takes his plea will be the one to preside at sentencing, where that judge retains discretion at sentencing, and where that judge is still available and sitting on the bench, that judge should preside over the appeal.
Ms. Thomas,
over the sentencing hearing.
In Clark County, almost all of the appeals are taken by a delegated master. This rule would eliminate that process.
Your Honor, I've thought about that. It's not an issue.
Would that render all of the criminal pleas that have been taken for the past, I don't know how many years the master's been doing this, void?
And all of those
sentences would have to be revisited as plain error?
I don't believe so, and here's why. When defendants enter a plea before the hearing master, they know that the hearing master, they know through their counsel, that hearing master will not be the judge conducting the sentencing. The identity of the sentencing judge is known at that point. A case is assigned to a judge in justice court or the return of the grand jury indictment. And so a defendant there might know, my case is tracking to Judge Smith. The hearing after, hearing master is acting in Judge Smith's behalf in accepting this plea. And so the defendant has that expectation of who's, at the time the plea is entered, of knowing who will be the sentencing judge.
That's how it is in the federal court here, too, in our district, isn't it?
Where I believe
the magistrates take the plea and then the district judge. Also, when you, Chief Justice had mentioned something about there's no case law, what about Cripps versus State, which talks about, it was written by one of our scholars as far as I was concerned, it was a majority opinion, by the way, where it said a judge may indicate whether he or she is inclined to accept the sentencing recommendation of the parties. In the event that the judge expresses such an inclination but later reconsiders and concludes that the recommendation will not be followed, the judge must permit the defendant an opportunity to withdraw the plea and proceed to trial prior to sentencing. So doesn't that give you an indication that the person, that the judge taking the plea, or excuse me, the judge who is expected to be sentenced the defendant, you have a right to be sentenced by that judge? Sounds like a
double crossing. Your Honor, I have not included the Cripps case in my briefing. I think you're correct. I think that that is an indication. And I think that's where the reasonable expectation comes into play here, is at every stage of the plea negotiation process, the prosecutors and defense attorneys, when they're first discussing a plea with each other, know the identity of the judge. And the terms of those pleas are going to be different depending on
counsel,
who the judge is.
Counsel, how do we deal with those matters that are going to overflow? And at the time of trial, a plea is then entered. Does it, unless they specify, does it go to the trial judge, so assumed, or does it go back to the original Department of Origin?
I think the best practice would be for the parties to specify who it should go to at the time of sentencing.
But is there any call out, because you're talking about expectation, unless the party states what that expectation is and makes that part of the plea agreement, how are we to know? And the same if you have a visiting judge, because the judge is ill.
And again, I think the best practice, and I realize we're talking about a new area of law here, and it's an important issue to the administration of the district court. I think once this court acts on this case, it's going to set some guidance for the district court and the parties to make this clear on the record. In the case of a visiting judge, I would expect the parties to either say no, would rather wait for the permanent judge, or we expect that Judge Smith will be doing the sentencing, and that should be made a clear matter of record, as it is a very important part of the plea process.
Why can't you, as a matter of course, and make that part of the plea agreement?
It could be made part of the plea agreement.
What precludes you from doing that, and don't you end up in the same spot?
It absolutely could be made part of the plea agreement. But I think in this case, especially when you look at the plea colloquy, and this was not an easy plea to get down. The plea went on for quite a ways. And there was repeated reference to the fact that Judge Gonzalez, she repeatedly stated, I and me, both of the attorneys referenced you in referring to the district court.
But isn't that part of the normal colloquy that the court uses?
I think it probably depends on the judge. I would expect a visiting judge might not. I expect the visiting judge
might say,
Well, part
of it, even today, 6-7 years later, doing the colloquy in terms of telling the party, you know, I will make the decision, no one else, and this, that, and the other, that's just part of the standard statement that the court is making to the person who's entered the plea, is saying to tell them that the judge is making the decision, not which judge, but just the judge in general.
I think to a lay defendant who's hearing a judge use terms like I and me, and who's saying, yes, I'll review that sentencing memorandum, I'll take those factors into consideration, that all of that highly suggests that that is the judge who will be entering, or conducting the sentencing. I would expect that if a visiting judge were taking a plea, if an overflow judge were taking a plea, they would say your judge, or they would reference the other judge who would be taking the plea.
And you're saying that Master Williams used to do that, and the current master does that currently, that they identify the sentencing judge as part of the plea discussions?
Or certainly the identity of the judge is known to the parties. It's known
on the information of the indictment, the department number.
And I don't... I've never been in front of a hearing master, so this is all third hand. But it's my understanding that the hearing master also has an understanding of the fact that Judge Mosley won't take Alford pleas. And so she's not going to take an Alford plea if a case is assigned to Department 14.
What will we do in the present case with, I can't think of the department number, but former District Court Judge Wall, if he was handling criminal matters? His department is now vacant, so to speak. We have a stream of senior judges coming in. How does anyone know if they're taking the plea, who's going to be sitting that day in that department?
They don't, and I expect that that's something the defense attorney would discuss with his client and say, this position is vacant, we don't know who the judge is going to be. I can't give you any advice as to predicting what the judge will do because we don't know who it is.
Well, he'll no longer be a 50-50 judge, that department. It'll be a civil department. Is that correct? Isn't the way we do it here in part time?
I believe that's correct. If I may very briefly address the other issue. I think what happened in the sentencing hearing was an aberration. The words that were used were horrible, and they should never have been uttered in a sentencing hearing. And I think that Mr. Dudon is entitled to a new sentencing hearing, one in which the witnesses are sworn and advised as to the proper scope of a victim impact statement. And that's why I think this issue should still be addressed, even though it wasn't raised below, because I would like you to reverse this on the sentencing issue, and then it's going to go back for sentencing if the court agrees.
What made it so fundamentally unfair?
Your Honor, the words that were used here, the threats, the racially derogatory...
And I read them. I don't disagree.
They were horrible. And no court proceeding should be so tainted as to have those words as a part of the proceeding without an instant admonition from the court that that's improper. And I would urge you to give Mr. Dudon a new sentencing hearing. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time, if I may.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, Susan Pate with the District Attorney's Office, the respondent in this matter. There is no right in Nevada for a defendant who enters a plea before one judge to be sentenced by that same judge. What happened in this case is the defendant went to court, did not object to the judge who sentenced him, and then after being sentenced, didn't like what he got and was grasping at straws and asking this court to adopt a California case as the standard, which is inappropriate. The case that the appellant relies upon in Arbuckle is a California case that was revisited by the same court in People v. Serrato. In that case, it said it is not always an implied term of the plea agreement that the judge who accepts the plea will impose a sentence. Rather, the record must affirmatively demonstrate some basis upon which a defendant may reasonably expect that the judge who accepted the plea will retain sentencing discretion. There is nothing in the record to indicate that Mr. Dudon, upon entering his plea, did so with the expectation that Judge Betsy Gonzalez would be the judge rendering sentence. In fact, the Serrato court goes on to say that even if you find that the plea was entered with a certain expectation that a particular judge would sentence, the next issue is whether the defendant waived his right to for reassignment to the judge who accepted the plea to the new judge. A contemporaneous objection requirement has been applied to the Arbuckle right. So even if this court wanted to adopt Arbuckle, which I urge this court not to for reasons I'll discuss later, you still have to determine whether it was a contemporaneous objection, and if not, then the Arbuckle right is waived. And at sentencing, Judge Smith asked, is there any legal reason why we should not go forward with sentencing today? The answer was, no, Your Honor. So the defendant waived any rights he had, which again, we submit he did not have any rights at that point. However, any rights he had, he did not object at that time. It was only after his sentence was rendered. The appellant also cites one more case, a Michigan case, as persuasive law. In Humble, the court said, a defendant is entitled to be sentenced before the judge who accepts his plea, provided that judge is reasonably available. Again, there's no reason for the Nevada court to adopt the Michigan rule. However, even if you look at Humble as persuasive, we have to look at reasonably available. Well, Judge Gonzalez was not reasonably available. She was a 50-50 hearing, or 50-50 criminal civil judge, and then she became fully civil. It's not reasonably available for a civil judge to then hear certain cases because they simply took the plea. In fact, the ABA standard cited in the appellate brief says, if guilt was determined by a plea, the judge who accepted the plea should preside in sentencing proceedings
unless the system of rotating assignment of judges in a multi-judge court makes that unfeasible. That's what we have here. We have a rotating system of judges. Most of your honors have been in that rotating system of judges and are familiar with how that works. What would it do to the court who hears civil matters solely to then have to stop their calendar to hear a sentence on a case merely because they took the plea? Further, Nevada Revised Statute 3.220 vests the district courts with equal and coextensive and concurrent jurisdiction, and furthermore, 3.250 says a chief judge allows, the statute allows the chief judge to adopt regulations that are necessary for the orderly conduct of the court. So the chief judge is allowed to decide what judges are appropriate to hear civil cases, what judges are appropriate to hear criminal cases, and if this court were to adopt a rule that the appellant wants, then you're basically taking that discretion away from the district court chief judge. From a practical standpoint, your honors, we're basically hitting on some things I had wanted to point out. In Clark County, we have hearing masters who hear the majority of the pleas. They don't hear the sentences. We have judges who are up for re-election on an ongoing basis, judges who put their names in for other courts. Those judges, if the court were to accept the standard, would not be allowed or shouldn't be allowed to take pleas within 60 to 90 days of their re-election because they might not be available for sentencing.
Ms. Pate, could I interrupt your presentation just with a quick question? The underpinnings of the Arbuckle decision is the finding of an implied term at the taking of the plea that the judge who received the plea will conduct the sentencing. Can one say, under the system you're talking about, that there exists an implied term? Can the court find an implied term in the plea agreement taken by a master that a given district court judge will hear the sentence? And if so, yes, and if not, why not?
I would say no. I would say if there were something in the plea to indicate that a specific judge made a specific promise or indicated specific things that they would do, then that defendant might have a reason to have an implied expectation to be sentenced by that judge. But in a case such as this, Judge Gonzalez made no promises, no indications of what she might do. If you have a judge saying, well, if you plead guilty, then I won't sentence you to the large habitual, and then he shows up to court as a different judge and that doesn't happen, there might be some implied expectation. But if you read the plea canvas, all that Judge Gonzalez said is she would read any report submitted by the special public defender prior to sentencing. Well, Judge Smith indicated he read the defendant's pre-sentencing memorandum. So that was the only thing Judge Gonzalez said she would do. She never indicated, oh, I'll give you concurrent time, I'll give you consecutive time. She indicated basically she would be fair and read all the material before rendering her decision. So I don't know why Abel Diadon, before entering this plea, did so only with the expectation of Judge Gonzalez sentencing him. There was nothing personal about this plea. There was no relationship. There was no knowledge that she had that Judge Smith didn't have. In fact, if you look at the history of this case, probably Judge Gonzalez had more information that would have been harmful to the defendant's sentence. She had considered a motion to suppress his statement, so presumably she had read the entire statement that he had given to the police, in which he gives a false statement, lied to the police, and then ultimately admits his involvement. I wouldn't presume Judge Smith to have read the entire statement. There wouldn't have been a reason to. Also, there had been a pending motion to admit prior bad acts that was to be decided on the same day that the defendant entered his plea, and in that motion it outlined very damning facts about another case that the defendant committed in a very similar manner to this murder. So if anything, she had more information that was more harmful to the defendant than what Judge Smith said.
Let me ask you about an implied thought that that Judge Gonzalez would sentence the defendant. I'm looking at a plea, part of the colloquy. It says, okay, sir, other than the recitation Mr. Vindrup has made that he has promised you he'll file a pre-sentence memorandum with me for me to review that's going to raise the issues that you believe are important to me, consider at the time of sentencing, have any other promises been made to you other than what's contained in the guilty plea agreement? The fact that she kept on saying me, does that change your mind? And also, if in fact it doesn't, wasn't this defendant entitled at least to an evidentiary hearing so that specific findings could be made as to whether or not there was an implied promise that just Judge Gonzalez would sentence him rather than another judge?
No, I don't think so. Courts do use the court, me, interchangeably. Some like to be more formal, some like to take a more informal tone. I still don't think that indicates that Mr. Diadone expected Judge Gonzalez herself. I don't know what purpose an evidentiary hearing would serve. There's nothing that Judge Gonzalez knew about the case that Judge Smith wasn't aware of in terms of sentencing. I guess you would have to look at, well, what did Judge Smith do that was inappropriate and that rendered him the wrong person to render the sentence in this case? Is there something in the record that indicates, well, he deviated significantly from what Judge Gonzalez would have done? And the answer is no.
What about the troubling remarks, though, that he tolerated in his courtroom that your adversary brought out at the end of her argument? What about this piece of that of the case?
Well, Your Honor, with all due respect to victims who give statements, they can be powerful at times. However, I don't think that the sentence in this case was based on any victim impact statement. And I say that for a couple of reasons. First of all, the Department of Parole and Probation had prepared a pre-sentence investigation report where they actually recommended a larger sentence than what Judge Smith rendered. And in that report, they indicate that they were never able to contact any of the victims in this case. So they recommended that sentence based on the history, based on the criminal activity of the defendant, and without any victim impact statement. They still recommended consecutive time on all counts and a more significant sentence on count one than what Judge Smith gave. Furthermore, after Judge Smith's sentence, he said, based on the defendant's history, it's escalating, or he's climbing up the ladder, were his exact words. So I don't think there's any reason to think that there was something that the victim said that really caused the sentence to be rendered. The defendant pled guilty to conspiracy to commit robbery, robbery with use of a deadly weapon, and murder. He went into a woman's house trying to steal marijuana and shot her in the back as she was fleeing while her young child was present. There was also another case that was done, again, in a similar manner. Nobody was killed, but it was a kidnapping robbery that was dismissed as part of the negotiation.
I understand that, but my concern is this. This gentleman was there for sentencing, and unsworn victim impact statements were permitted, and they went seriously out of bounds with respect to racial epithets and the like. What is your comment about the standard of review we should apply in this setting? I'm really more on the second point of the argument than the first.
Okay, understood. It's abuse of discretion. And I would point out that the appellant did not object. He did not ask the witnesses to be sworn in. He never cross-examined the victims. I think he has waived that issue as well. Furthermore, if you read the statements, it's four pages out of one out of the transcript. So whether they're inappropriate or not, it wasn't a belabored sentencing. I've been present where victims have spoken for 30 minutes. It's very powerful. This was very limited. Although it was inflammatory, there were a lot of emotions going on with that family. They had lost a loved one. But I don't think, again, if you look at the record, that Judge Smith based a sentence on that. And again, if you look, that he actually put this matter back on calendar to reconsider his sentence to follow the terms of the guilty plea agreement. At that time, there weren't any victims there. If the court's basically asking, well, was Judge Smith so influenced by the emotional power of the victim speakers that that's why he gave the sentence he did? Well, when it was back on calendar, the victims weren't there. He could have done anything he wanted, and he still chose to run count three consecutive. But he did run the other counts concurrent to count one. So I don't think, even if the court finds that it was error to allow the victims to speak, first of all, that issue was waived. The defense attorneys never...
I'm not saying it was error to allow them to speak. They have the right to speak.
Well, say what they said, I understand.
Well, do they all have the right to speak, though? Do best friends have a right to speak as opposed to the sisters that were speaking?
Well, again, they did not object. And
but it doesn't... It's not in accord with the statute, is that right?
They have a relationship to the victim, so they were impacted by what happened. And that's not actually outlined...
It's not in the statute that way, though. It didn't say...
Well, that's, with all due respect, that's not one of the basis of the defense attorney's objection. They never objected to allowing these people to speak. It was the content of what they said after the fact, after the sentence was rendered, that they didn't like. There's nothing in the record to indicate that they objected, that they had a problem with it while it was happening. And again, even if the court finds error, you have to look at what did Judge Smith do? Did his sentence, is it an abuse of discretion? I don't think so. The defendant had two prior felony convictions, was on probation at the time he committed this murder. So I don't think 20 years to life is excessive for what the defendant did. I don't think there's any indication Judge Smith abused his discretion. It was in line with what the probation department recommended. So frankly, whether it was appropriate to allow people to speak or not, I don't think that had any impact on his decision.
Who sentenced the co-defendant?
That was Judge Vega, Your Honor, and he was sentenced after the defendant entered his plea. I have the Department of Parole and Probation recommendation there. They recommend a concurrent time, which is what Judge Vega followed. So if there's an issue about the discrepancy, that defendant did not have a criminal history at all prior to entering his plea. Also, he was remorseful for his actions as opposed to the defendant, who just simply shifted blame.
How did the case get to Vega instead of Gonzalez?
They came in separately. When Mr. Theodon confessed, they arrested him and then eventually made a case on Mr. McNair. So they were never technically co-defendants, although they committed the crimes together.
Thanks.
So I don't think Mr. Theodon had any expectation that he would get the same sentence or a lighter sentence as Mr. McNair, because that sentence hadn't been imposed yet. Judge Vega could have done whatever she wanted. That both judges followed the recommendation of the Department of Parole and Probation, although Judge Smith actually gave a lighter sentence than what they recommended. Basically, the court shouldn't allow this to follow the Arbuckle rule. It promotes judge shopping. We are to assume that all judges are in the same position. They look at the facts. They don't base their decisions necessarily on emotion or a certain relationship with the defendant. To be honest, defendants come in, I don't know how much you remember of any particular person, but she took a plea. That's all she did. She made no promises. The defendant had no reason to expect anything from Judge Gonzalez. He didn't object to Judge Smith. He could have gotten a better sentence out of Judge Smith. It was a coin toss. And it's simply Monday morning quarterback. He didn't like the sentence. He wants this court to rule in his favor so he can maybe get a better sentence. And of course, there's no reason to expect that necessarily to happen. Whether you send it back to Judge Smith, whether you send it back to Judge Gonzalez, he got the sentence recommended by the Department of Parole and Probation. It's appropriate. I don't think there's any reason to reconsider it. I have 24 seconds left. Any questions? All right.
I have one question. On footnote one of the appellant's opening brief is the reference to the direct appeal from the order denying the defendant's motion to vacate this sentence and plea, or sentence. Why doesn't that disposition stand as law of the case, obviating the issue with respect to Arbuckle on this appeal?
Well, Your Honor, I think it should be law of the case. I don't think that there is any basis for it to even be before Your Honors, but frankly, we got the notice to be here, so I'm here arguing it, but I would say that they have not properly filed their appeal, and they're raising issues that are outside that motion.
But you didn't raise that in your briefs.
No. Thank you.
I can briefly address a few issues. First, the Serrato decision is not a decision by the California Supreme Court. It's a decision of the California Court of Appeals, which is in conflict with other Court of Appeals decisions. As to the, there were several facts that were mentioned that are not included within this record, and I'm therefore not in a position to address them. The culpability of the co-defendant, his remorse, none of that is included within this record. Also, the defendant here admitted to guilt under a felony murder theory as an accomplice, and fully understanding the felony murder rule, but there's no basis in this record to find that he is the shooter of this woman.
Could you address the jurisdiction with respect to the Arbuckle issue? I asked it at the conclusion of your opponent's remarks.
Sure. And that issue, this court dismissed that appeal on jurisdictional grounds. It did not ever address the merits. There is no contrary merits finding. Depending on how this goes, that issue may very well be back in front of this court after the Lozada appeal is resolved. The lower court has said it wants to wait for this appeal to be over before addressing the appointment of counsel for that appeal. But I think the fact that we have a final judgment here in the form of the judgment of conviction, the amended judgment of conviction, all issues presented in the case up until the filing of the notice of appeal are properly before this court. And the Arbuckle issue is therefore appropriately considered by this court. Justice Cherry, you mentioned that the victims are not identified as victims under the statute. This court issued a decision in Wood versus State, I believe it's 1995, in which it states that district courts have discretion to allow non-victims to speak at sentencing hearings. And if the court would like supplemental briefing on that, I'm more than happy to do that, but that's the reason the issue was not raised. because this court does have controlling authority on that point. Counsel for the state is correct in that there is no guarantee that Judge Gonzalez would have given a different sentence. But the fact is that the attorneys in this case have an expectation of Judge Gonzalez based upon her past actions. The defendant who sat in the courtroom and observed Judge Gonzalez in other cases during the morning calendar has an expectation. Defendants who are at the detention center in a prison who have not a lot else to talk about what different judges are like. And all of those are factors in deciding, should I take this plea or not? And while there's no guarantee of a sentence, there is an expectation that a trial judge is going to act as they have acted in past cases. And that's what was expected here, that Judge Gonzalez took this plea. She understood the issues as raised by trial counsel regarding the co-defendant, regarding the situation of the defendant turning himself in, and all of those other factors. And I submit that he should have been sentenced in front of Judge Gonzalez, that he should be sent back for sentencing in front of Judge Gonzalez. So what if Judge Gonzalez sentences someone the same day she hears a civil calendar? We can deal with this. It's within that's a reasonable action. It's reasonable for a judge to finish out the few cases that they have remaining when they switch to a different calendar. She's still sitting on the bench. She's still here. She's not retired, not deceased. And under these circumstances where discretion is retained under for sentencing, where the judge is still available, that judge should hear the sentencing. And again, as to the racial issue, even if Judge Smith was not altered by those statements, those were horrible, horrible statements. And that whole proceeding should be called a nullity based upon those actions. Thank you.
All right. Counsel, thank you so much for being here today. We appreciate the briefs and your arguments. And this matter will stand submitted.